Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates.
Hello. Just wandering around trying to find a quiet space in the house. Let's try this room. No, one in there. One in there. I'm going to sit on the stairs. I quite like sitting on the stairs. I had a late night last night. I went and sang in Tetsford. Oh, now Richard's coming down the stairs. I can't find anywhere quiet now. Yeah, the gentle sound of his Birkenstocks going past. Last night I was in Tetsworth in Oxfordshire singing for Ed Harcourt and his wife Geeta's fundraiser for War Child. It was really lovely. I sang in the church. I got to sing Like a Prayer in a church. Hold on, Jess, I'll be down a second. And then Friday night I went to the circus, and that was amazing. And now Mickey is pretty obsessed with circus stuff. We've been listening to circus music playlists on Spotify today. He's convinced he can do tricks and flips. And I also sang at the rugby premiership final yesterday at Twickenham Stadium, which is quite fun. So, yes, it's been a busy old weekend. And that's why I've only just managed to sit down to record this now. It's 7 p.m. on Sunday night. Oh, it's like handing your homework in late. but I have got a really fascinating chat for you with Gemma Kemp, who is a forensic pathologist. So she does postmortems, and she actually contacted me, and she said, she wrote to my management actually and said, I think I'd be a really good person for you to speak to because of my job. Which led me to think a lot about what caused her to contact me, because obviously it's one thing to say, yes, it's important. I've got an interesting job. Of course, that's great. But I thought, what else? And I wondered if it's because Gemma's clearly brilliant at her job, and it's clearly also something she really enjoys, but it's also very demanding and emotionally quite challenging. And I wondered if it was just quite nice for her to sort of say, I'm here and I do this. And sometimes some of it's really hard. And that doesn't mean she doesn't enjoy her work, but just it's quite nice to acknowledge that it's challenging, because probably working doing autopsies is quite a lot of the time quite a, I don't know, quite a quiet skill. You're on your own a lot of times with, you know, in a room with dead bodies, and maybe, you know, it's nice just to share aspects of that which are quite profound and poignant. And what is quite interesting is that only the week before last, I had my own experience that was also quite poignant dealing with death. And that is, now just be prepared, this story is a little bit shocking, but I went away to Liverpool and I was doing a gig. It was a private party that I was singing at. So I went with just my sound guy and tour manager, Duncan, and we just pulled up at the hotel that we were going to stay at. So it was about 6:45 at night. I was on stage at 9:30, so I had a couple of hours to eat supper, get ready. And as I got out the taxi, I went round to the back of the boot to collect my bag. And at the same time, the multi-storey car park opposite us, something caught my eye, and then there was a very loud sound of something hitting the ground. And my first thought was, oh, someone's taken like a very heavy bag out of their boot and it's just chucked it over the side of the multi-storey car park. Well, in fact, it wasn't a bag. It was a person. And it turned out that at the same time as Duncan and I were getting out of the taxi, someone had also decided to take their own life. And they jumped from the top of this, I don't know, 13, 14 storey car park. And the reason I'm sharing that with you is because it made me think about some of the things that Gemma said about the relationship she has with the person who comes to her when they're dead, and how she feels a sort of relationship with them in giving them justice for however they died. Now, sometimes, of course, that's just natural causes. Sometimes, you know, with the question mark, obviously, otherwise you wouldn't do an autopsy. But sometimes there are question marks, and it's up to Gemma and her colleagues to figure out what's gone on. So I felt a similar thing with this man who had jumped. I thought, I wonder what was going on with him that had led him to think that that was the only solution he had left. And given that it was only Duncan and I and the taxi driver that stood there, I thought about the fact that it's quite poignant that we were there in the last moments of that guy's life. And I don't know who he was, and I don't know if there's any way of me finding out who he was. But if anyone has lost someone recently in that way, then yes, I can. I don't know, I suppose you just think about the concentric circles, don't you, of who's affected by, I don't know, the actions when people take them like that. I always thought about the friends and family, but I never really thought about witnesses, bystanders. Anyway, I suppose I'm just mulling on it, really. It's quite nice to talk about it with you. And with Gemma's chat, obviously we had to be quite careful about confidentiality with the people she's talking about and the cases. And something that we had to edit out was some of Gemma's first cases, because of the level of detail we went into in our chat. So I understand why it's taken out. But with Gemma's permission, I can share with you that there was one really poignant description she gave of her first cases. She did three autopsies on the same, on her first day that she was actually actively doing them, she did three in one day. Mommy! Yes, Mickey, coming! And one of them was a teenage boy who'd been involved in a road traffic accident, and they'd had to cut his puffer jacket off, which meant that Gemma was in a room with this young boy, and feathers from his puffer jacket were, hold on, Mickey, I don't really want that, YouTube kids, were like flying up in the air while she was with him. And I thought that was almost quite painterly, but also really, again, poignant was that word again, I guess. Anyway, sorry for the waffling on, but I had a lot to say. And you've now, Mickey seems to be watching something about a dinosaur. Oh, giving birth to another dinosaur. What happened there, Mickey? Anyway, having fun in the sun. I will see you on the other side. Thanks for joining me. So
So, Gemma, yeah, you're one of like three people, I think, that I've ended up talking to who've put themselves forward for chatting to me, which I really love because I think with this whole thing with the podcast, I think it's really lovely when people think, actually, I don't feel I've quite been represented. And you're right, your job is something I've never spoken to anybody who does what you do, but I'm deeply fascinated. So the treat is all mine. So why don't we start with that? What is it that you do for a living?
Okay, so I'm a forensic pathologist, which means I'm a medical doctor. So I went through medical training and trained in pathology. Essentially, the main part of my role is to do autopsies, also called post-mortem examinations, which is examining the body after death to determine how they died. So we have what we term routine post-mortem examinations, or PMs, where there's not any suspicious circumstances. So there's kind of two categories. There's the forensic side, which is suspected homicide, murder, and the routine cases, which is where you just don't know why someone has died for a medical reason, or there may be an accident or suicide, drug-related, alcohol, all those sorts of categories. So if someone died in those circumstances, if you're in England, it would, or England and Wales, it would be the coroner that instructed the post-mortem examination. In Scotland, where I work, it's the Procurator Fiscal. So I do those. I do basically any type of autopsy, absolutely any scenario whereby someone has died.
And I don't know if you'll be able to answer this, but how frequently does a dead body need an autopsy?
I don't actually know the percentages, but I think it's not as many as you would think, because most people who die, they are elderly and or they have a long-term condition, and thereby their doctor would be able to write up a death certificate for them. Mm-hmm. So, but it, yeah, it, we've certainly got enough to keep us occupied.
Yeah, so this is, okay, so of a typical week, are you generally working Monday to Friday?
Yes, and then there will be on call around that. So I might be on call for a few days in the week, or I might not, or I might be on the weekend. Okay. But yes, the kind of day-to-day routine. So we have routine post-mortem examinations every morning where I work. Mm-hmm. And there's always plenty of them because I work in a big department with a big team. So in other parts of the country, they maybe have smaller mortuaries and they don't have so many postmortems every single day. They might have them every few days or something like that. But because I work in a large department, we always have them every day.
Every day?
Every day.
Okay. And how long have you been doing that?
So I've been a consultant, so a fully qualified forensic pathologist, for nearly 8 years. And before that, I was in training for a long time. It takes a long time to train.
Yeah, I think my producer, Claire, was telling me about 13 years. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, so I graduated in 2004 and then was fully qualified 2014. So that's like 10 years. I mean, I could have done it quicker, but I had trouble getting my exam for the first time and I had a baby. So I kind of lengthened the period of my training with that.
Okay, so you were having a baby around the time that you were also qualifying?
I got pregnant. At the end of your training, you have a final exam, which is 2.5 days of being examined.
Ooh, that's intense.
It's very intense. It's quite horrific.
Is that a practical you're doing there?
Practical and oral and written and microscope slides. There's five components.
Being watched?
Yes.
Whoa. Yes. Is your hand really shaking while you're doing it?
Yes.
It's like sort of take the idea of like a driving exam and then like amplify.
By a million.
Oh my word. So when did you get pregnant then? And that sort of...
So I did my first attempt at the exam when I wasn't pregnant and then I rebooked. And by the time I resat it 6 months later, I was, I think, 16 or 18 weeks pregnant after a really horrific first trimester. So feeling really, really nauseous, which is really good when you
great timing for
looking inside
off
people.
I mean, I'm laughing mirthlessly, but actually that must have been really, really tricky. And you obviously passed that second time as well.
No, I passed the third time.
Oh, okay.
So then that was actually the first time I left my baby, was to go and sit the exam.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I had to go. I was living in Newcastle then and I had to go to Liverpool and I'd never left her. She was 13 months. And, yeah, I was bawling at the airport, not just from leaving it, but the stress of the exam. So stressful, because it felt like, oh, you've got to get it now. You've got to get it now, you know, because you have to get it to qualify. So.
Yeah. And you've been through it a few times and you've had that time off and had your baby and thinking, right, got to get back into that. And did you ever question going back to finish?
Oh, no, not at all. No, I was very much... I needed to only take 6 months off for financial reasons anyway, and I needed to get back in to get, you know, it was just to have the time to study. But, I mean, it's hard to study when you have a six-month-old to a year, you know.
Yeah, and how are you finding that in your headspace, sort of studying? And do you remember it?
I just, very well. Not really. I can remember sitting at the kitchen table, like, studying, and also, you know, I'd already done it twice, so it's kind of... Yeah, the knowledge was there. It's just a hard exam whereby, and it's kind of opinion based. That probably just sounds like sour grapes. I wasn't good enough, but you know, it was. You have two examiners, and they make the decision. So, it was, and it was the first time I'd failed anything. It was really hard because you know I'd always been sort of high achiever and passed all my exams to get to medical school, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So that was a real, you know, kind of. Failing something so important for the first time and being a new mother. Yeah, it was a really hard time.
Yeah, and I wonder actually if that's quite a common character trait for people who tend to end up in those sort of professions, that they tend to be highly academic, therefore pretty high achievers in that as well, studious, you know, and so that first time of failing must have felt like a real shock, and then doing it again sort of into a pregnancy and thinking...
Yeah.
You know, my head's feeling a bit scrambled here and I don't quite feel like myself if you're really feeling unwell as well.
Yeah, it was. It was like that. And I had a very amazing boss at the time. And the second time when I failed, when I was pregnant, he just turned up at the door with flowers, which meant the world to me.
Oh, that's nice.
It was really lovely. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But your determination that this was the field you wanted to...
Absolutely. Be in. Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And what had made you want to choose it in the first place? How does that... Was it a sort of... narrowing down as you went through your medical training, or do you have to already know that's where you're headed when you start?
I mean, it depends on the person, you know, it's up to them. For me, I always wanted to be a doctor from very young, like 8 years old. I was just fascinated with the way the human body works. It just completely gripped me. And then sort of when I was in my teenage years and working towards my GCSEs and A-levels, and I have to admit it, it was the telly programmes, you know, this looks interesting. And I can remember, because this is pre-internet, I had to go to the school library and look it up in a careers book, you know, a forensic pathologist. And it said you needed a medical degree. And I remember in my cocksure 16-year-old way, oh, well, I'm already going to do that, so I'll just do that.
Amazing.
And so just, yeah, and the thing is, because it's dealing with death and not living people, you have to kind of keep it on the QT because you have to sell my caring side. That sounds really awful. Like, oh, I'm pretending. I do care, honestly, but I just really wanted to do that job.
But, okay, why is that the bit that... what was it about it that really appealed?
I think it's just fascinating. I mean, it really is. And every day is different and you're learning something new every single day, you know. And I know most of medicine is like that. But I think as well, because with the post-mortem examination, you need to know a lot about all the body systems. It's kind of like you're a GP of death. You know, you have to sort of know about a background of a lot of things, often reading up, obviously, because you can't know everything about everything. But... it's that and the human interest, because you get a little tale of the lead up to this person's death and a little snippet of their life and what was happening. And it's just fascinating. It's amazing. Like, and some of the stories, you know, truth is always stranger than fiction. We get interesting. It's really, really fascinating. And I've never lost that fascination, even though... You know, obviously the practicalities are a bit more difficult these days. When I was in training, I was like, oh, let's hang around, let's stay on. And now I'm working out how long it's going to take me, whether I can pick my kids up from school.
Those things that the sort of other factors of life kind of come in around, you know, to sort of sit alongside all these things that we want for ourselves too. And I think, you know, I asked about you know, what it is about that, you know, about forensic pathology. But I completely get the idea of the fascination of it. And it's funny because I know you said about keeping it on the quiet on one hand, but actually I think culturally we've kind of got quite a weird juxtaposition sometimes, haven't we, between an awkwardness with aspects of death, but in terms of entertainment, a complete fascination with it, actually.
Yeah, certainly, yeah.
And I know that the programme Silent Witness is credited as actually seeing a big uptake in young women heading towards your profession.
Certainly.
Well. So, you know, so sometimes it's a really direct thing of entertainment influencing things.
Yes, I mean, there's more women in medicine now anyway. Like, I think there's more than half in the entry, so you're going to get more women in medicine represented, although there are still more male-dominated fields like surgery because of the hours, I think. The hours and the culture, I don't know. I mean, I never really went into that, but certainly there's been a change in forensic pathology. When I started out with my interest in my early 20s, you know, making an interest, it was definitely male dominated. There weren't that many women in it, and now it's definitely more level, it's more even. Yeah.
Typically, how much information do you get about the people you're about to perform an autopsy on?
Usually quite a lot. So the police have to produce like a sudden death report. So you'll get like their background medical history and the circumstances that led up to their death, you know, because you need to know all that to be able to put it into context of your findings from the autopsy to be able to come up with the reason, really. You know, you can't just go in knowing nothing. You need to know their background health and what's happened, basically, because a lot of it is putting together what you found with the circumstances. Because you need to come up with a cause of death, which is just one line or two lines or something. But then in your report, you need to formulate conclusions where you discuss, does this fit? You know, say someone's fallen from a height, do the injuries fit that? Were they in a road traffic collision? Say they were a pedestrian hit by a car, you might get asked questions about the position they were in, things like that. So you always need to know as much background as possible to correlate it with the pathological findings.
But that's quite practical, that, like they were found in this position, this is what we think happened in the accident. But do you get things that are sort of surrounding that, like their medical history up to then, and maybe this is what they did for a profession, this is what, you know, their family? Do you get information like that as well?
Yes, we do. I mean, it's variable. In some places I've worked before, you got quite scanty information, but where I work currently, we get a lot of information. Yeah, so that's good.
Well, is it always helpful to know all those things?
I mean, you know, in terms of practicalities and time, you can't always, they're quite lengthy reports, and right. You have to kind of skim through to find the pertinent information. But if it's more involved, or, you know, and then you need to, it's always good to have more information than less.
Yes, I can imagine that. But I suppose I'm thinking, I don't know, like I don't have a problem when I'm watching a film and there's violence in a film. But if I see anything remotely aggressive in real life, I find it quite shocking. And for some people, when it comes to actually a real person in front of them, is it too much for some people? Have you seen people studying and then thinking, I can't actually do this?
Not personally. I think if you come into your training, you've got far enough to know that you can deal with that. Yeah, I think you have to. We're a sort of self-selected bunch who you know that you can deal with it. And in some ways, from the emotional side, you know, I don't have patients who die. I don't know how, say, like a pediatrician does their job, that cares for a child, say, with cancer and the dad. I mean, to my mind, that's just, I don't know how you go home and cope with that.
Yeah.
You know, whereas when I see them, they've already died. I didn't know them when they were alive. So you got that kind of detachment.
Yeah.
The realization comes in with, say, having to meet the family or go to court and you see their family there, you know, and that's where it's like, that's what you do it for, you know, for them, for answers, for justice.
Well, I was going to say, do you feel like you're part of, like, actually there's a connection with you and that person? Obviously a connection that they'll never be aware of, but that you are helping keep a voice for them going beyond.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And you're often giving families closure and answers, and that is rewarding, you know.
Yeah.
So I work in Scotland now, so we don't have inquests. But when I worked in England and you have an inquest, you'd often meet the family and, you know, not always, but quite a lot of the time, they would be really thankful and grateful that you've taken the time to explain to them and answer their questions and things. And that's really, really rewarding. You know, that's kind of what you do it for. You know, you do it to do a good job and for justice, et cetera, but in terms of making that, you know, if I've helped in any way with someone's grief, then that's fantastic, you know.
And is that part of your training to understand about the family's grief and to think about justice, or is it more about the medical side of how you deduce what's going on?
Yes, it's much more medical. We don't really, yeah, there's no specific training in that sort of side of it. It's just experiential, you know.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because that's presumably ends up being quite a big part of the job.
Yeah, it does. And I was interested in this because I felt like it isn't really acknowledged, the kind of emotional impact on us. And it's very much a sort of, well, you pick this, get, you know, stiff up a lip, get on with it type thing. And so I did do a little survey among my colleagues. And I worked with a woman who was a student in psychology and occupational psychology. And she looked into it and she did some long form interviews with a few of my colleagues. And that's something I've been meaning to get published when I get a spare minute. And that was in conjunction with Dr. Richard Shepherd, who's written a book. It's his kind of memoir of his cases because he's retired, but he does touch on the impact that that had on him. And it was significant. And I know him, you know, I know him because it's a small profession. We all kind of know each other. We see each other at conferences and things like that. And he was very keen to get behind that exploration of the more. Yeah, because of course it's going to have an impact. Of course it is.
That's why I said it must take up and being quite a big bit. And it sounds a little bit like it's sort of passed on to you to just sort of fill in the gaps for where that is, because obviously it's pretty bespoke, that's how well you deal with those things. You know, there might be people that end up doing what you do because actually maybe something happened to someone that they knew and that ended up sparking, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why you get drawn to something that's got that sort of passion and vocational element to it. So that is interesting. And I wonder as well if that's part of a broader dialogue. I noticed recently, this might be something that's been going on for a long time, but it's sort of, I've noticed that there's much more books about people talking about the emotional impact of being involved in medical professions. It seems to be something that the conversation is happening more in that way.
Yes, I agree. I think it is. There's been lots more books and chat and just generally it's more acceptable to talk about things impacting you, I think, in society, isn't it? You know, people are more willing to say, actually, that was really upsetting. That was and come forward and either get professional help or even at least tell a friend. And the more of that, the better, because the suicide rates, the suicides I see, you know, it's a big problem, especially men and young men.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. And you're right, conversations and just having that support and places to put things like that, I can't really see a time when it hasn't really been beneficial. But as for you personally, it's one thing to have all that on your own, but when you're also raising a young family. So you had your first baby when you were qualifying.
Yes. I was sort of towards the end of my training.
And was that something, did you always want to be a mum?
Yes, I did. I just always did. And I never kind of questioned that I couldn't do both. I don't know why. I was just like, yes, I'm going to be a forensic pathologist and yes, I'm going to be a mother.
And yeah, it works out better when you don't question it, because we do. Most things lead to, this is not very practical, is it? Then you had your second, two girls, isn't it?
Yes, So I did my training in Newcastle, and then at the end, I would have happily stayed, but there wasn't a job for me, so that's why I ended up in Glasgow for the job. And I had my second daughter, I think, couple of years into that job. So there's 3.5 years between my girls.
Lovely. And have you managed to find what you're doing? When we spoke on the phone, you talked quite a lot about compartmentalisation. Is that something that you always knew you were quite good at or reliant on as a way of dealing with things?
I don't think I think of it in those terms. I just kind of get on with it, you know? And there's always so much to do that you don't sort of have the time to contemplate how you're dealing with it. I mean, I'm quite chatty and I'll always share cases with my colleagues, and I think that's good, you know? And I'll tell friends as well if something has upset me. And I think that's been enough, you know, to deal with it. But things stay with you, you know, certain cases stay with you. Fortunately, child deaths are few and far between. We don't see that many, but that means that I could probably remember every single child I've been involved in, you know. And that's worse when you're a mum, definitely. Like before I was a mother, it was still upsetting, but there's something about them getting to the age. So I can remember when Frankie, my eldest, was like 3, and it wasn't even my case. I was walking through the body store and there was a girl who looked just like her, being like prepared for a family viewing. And I was just like, I turned away. I was like, that's too close for comfort, because she had the same hairstyle and everything. And I was just like, I can't look at that. That's just, you know. So yeah, I think especially seeing children who are the age of your children, you know, it really brings it home. And but like, wow. I said, thankfully few and far between.
Yeah, but it's amazing. I mean, even hearing that story sort of secondhand is sort of knocks the wind out of you a little bit. And I didn't realize, so when you said the body store, can you describe, so when you're at work, is that just like one floor of the building? I'm just trying to picture it in my head.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's quite unusual where I work. I think it's probably the biggest mortuary in the UK. It's absolutely enormous.
No need to boast. You come from a different mortuary. No offence.
No offence to any other mortuary. It just happens to be.
You're doing really well too.
So, I mean, so the body store is two walls of fridges, and we've got storage for 300. So it's enormous. Wow. And then there's the post-mortem room, and then a series of other rooms where, but like I say, this is quite unusual. Most mortuaries are much smaller and only have like a few tables for doing the post-mortems and smaller body stores.
Okay. And are they often located within hospitals?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. So is your one located
in a hospital?
It is,
yes, yeah. But there are some city mortuaries, standalone buildings, which may be owned by the police. It's different places around the country of kind of historical what they've inherited in terms of. But yes, the majority of mortuaries are within hospitals, yeah.
And does it make you now completely unfazed by death, or do you feel like it's because it's contained within work? Have you ever been confronted by some death outside of work and explored how that feels, if it's different or the same? That makes sense.
Yes, it's like what you said before about seeing violence, and I don't think that gets any less shocking just because you've seen the end result of it, you know, in terms of real life. When I was a teenager, I witnessed an accident. I saw an old lady get hit by a bus and her leg almost amputated. I was 14. And that was so upsetting because
that's really shocking.
Because it was just like, and it was like it happened in slow motion, because I passed her on the road and I just knew she wouldn't get across the road in time, and I turned around and saw it happen. And that, I don't think anything I see in my job takes away from how shocking that would be, even though I was younger. You know, I think seeing an accident, seeing violence is always going to be shocking, irrespective of what I've seen. And I can look at a body with injuries and say, oof, you know, that's horrendous. You can imagine, you know. But I think you have to take a step back, because if you spend too much time standing there thinking, oh, that must have been painful and horrible, you know, you wouldn't be able to concentrate and do the job in hand.
So what happens then? What kicks in if you're looking at someone who's had something horrific happen to the end of their life? Like what kicks in to go, don't just stand there staring?
just practicalities, this job needs doing.
And you're often working alongside other people at that point, so they're maybe being, you know, because everybody does things in their own time, don't they?
Yeah, no, we just, in Scotland, we have two forensic pathologists because the Scottish law, you have corroboration, so you need two. So I actually do those cases with another, which is great because, you know, you have another colleague to discuss with and not that, you know, you could, other places where they do it on their own, that's totally valid as well, of course. You know, we're all experienced and everything, but that is, especially when you're starting out, that was a major advantage. And then you've got, you know, there's a mortuary technician there, there's a photographer there, there might be police officers there, everybody's there to do a job. Right. So you just get on with it.
Yeah. And how often then are you dealing with homicide? Is that quite a weekly thing?
It's like really unpredictable. It's unpredictable. You know, so you might get a week where you have a few, and then you might get a few weeks where you get none. It's just, you can't, there's no rhyme or reason to it.
And sometimes this results in you giving evidence. Is that always the outcome if you've worked on a...
Not necessarily, because you'd only give evidence in court if there's an actual trial. So if someone pleads guilty to murder, then there won't be a trial. Mm-hmm. Or if at the outcome there's not enough evidence to press charges, then you wouldn't go to court then. But yes, going to court is part of the career and a part that I think puts quite a few doctors off, because, you know, it's quite high pressure.
That's what I was going to say, because again, I think that's another skill set, being able to be in that environment and to effectively do public speaking and to be looked at and scrutinised and cross-examined. So is that part of your training?
Yes, as part of the forensic pathology training, we do an expert witness training course, because you're classed as an expert witness, which means that you're allowed to give opinion evidence to the court, whereas, say, an A&E doctor who documented an injury, they would be classed as a professional witness, so they're just giving evidence as to the facts, whereas I and others are allowed to say, I think this caused this person's death, or this caused this injury, and, you know, and it's quite nuanced. It's how certain are you, you know, and how certain can you be? Mm. And because, you know, there are cases where it's obvious, you know, a stab wound to the heart, you know, it's clear cut, that's what's happened, it's a person been stabbed with a knife, et cetera, et cetera. But then there are cases whereby someone's been assaulted, but there's lots of other factors, and you're trying to weigh up actually how did they die and how did they come by their death, as it were, what sequence of events led to that. And yeah, so it's, I mean, that's, again, yeah, that's a part of the job. It is performing. It is, you know, you have to be comfortable with standing up and, you know, speaking clearly and being sure of yourself and, yeah. Mm.
And so all the way alongside this, you've got your little girls. So how aware are they of what they... Sorry, and you have told me, but are they... Did you say 8 and 5?
9 and 5.
Nine and 5.
Yeah. Cool. Uh-huh. Probably too aware.
Quite a communicator. I'm like that as well, by the way. I tell my kids.
I tell them everything. I mean, obviously, not everything in terms of, like, you know, sexual violence. It has to be age appropriate, but they know what I do. I often get phone calls at dinner and they'll hear me arranging a post-mortem or something like that, or I'll be the mum in the corner of the school playground, like, ringing the mortuary and saying, we need to do this at this time, you know. So, yeah, no, they know. My five-year-old's told her teacher what mummy does, you know. So, yeah, I do wonder probably whether I should rein it in a bit, but I my elder girl... really likes, like, Operation Ouch and, you know, the BBC programme. And so I would never push them into medicine, but if that's what they want to do. She's just interested. She's read a few books and stuff like that. She finds it interesting.
Yeah, well, I think you'd hope that no matter what they end up doing, being fundamentally interested in how human beings work is mm-hmm. pretty sort of endlessly interesting to everybody, I would have thought. I did actually wonder, has it ever been that your medical training for examining dead bodies meant that you're able to work out what's happening with someone when they're alive and well, you know, seemingly well?
Well,
or, you know, got an ailment or something.
I mean, it's a bit rusty because I haven't treated any living people since 2005. But But I think some things stay with you. You know, you still know what sort of symptoms and signs people present with.
Well, it might be something you've seen in an autopsy and thought, when you do this, does it feel like that?
I mean, I can offer an opinion. It's a limited opinion. You know, if people come and, what's this rash? And think, like, my parents or something, what's this ailment? I'm like, no, not really my area of expertise, Mum.
And so during this time as well, we were talking on the phone, you were saying you're now a single mum as well.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
So how long has that been the case?
So we separated just after the first lockdown, and we were divorced last year.
Oh, wow. So you've had quite a dramatic couple of years.
It's been interesting times, yeah. Mm.
So I guess, you know, we talk a lot, broadly speaking, about things that make you feel like you're spinning a lot of plates. But that's another thing to introduce, isn't it, when you're going through something like that. And I know we spoke to Helen from, she does a comedy duo called Scummy Mummies, about divorce and about how that whole process is. And, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but I suppose, you know, how's that changed the dynamic of the relationship with you and your daughters? Has it been a big factor?
Luckily, we're on really good terms and he lives close by. So we still, you know, he sees them regularly and we still do things together as well. So that's really good. That's helped them. Obviously, when we first told them, they were devastated and it was really upsetting for all concerned because, you know, no one wants things to end. You don't get married to have that outcome, you know. But unfortunately, you know, that's the way things went. And I think it's, I don't see that much difference really. I think because I know that they'd say obviously they want us all in the same house together, but they're pretty level, you know, they seem pretty all right, I hope, you know. And me and my ex both foster a kind of just open, I just want them to be able to tell us anything that's on their mind, speak to us, you know, and I hope they can do that. I feel like they can.
And when you're working, how has work changed for you as your children have grown? Has it sort of stayed in the same place in your heart as what it was at the beginning, or does it sort of morph along when you're also raising a family?
That's a good question. No, I think it has. I mean, obviously, in terms of time, that's the main thing. But I just fit around them. And obviously, I can't work from home to do my post-mortem examinations.
That might be taking things a bit far.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think my neighbours would be impressed. But everything else I can, so I can write my reports from home, I can take calls. And that was something that we'd actually wanted before lockdown, COVID happened. Mm. And it had always been dismissed as too difficult technologically and in terms of security, in terms of the information we hold, you know, because it's medical records, it's private police records, things like that. And then within a few weeks of lockdown, we suddenly it had been solved and we got our laptops to go home, which has been an absolute game changer because it means that I can, you know, work with the kids in the house.
More flexibility.
Yeah, albeit the difficulty of having a smaller child when you're looking at injuries that they just barge in.
Oh, wow.
Quickly reduce down the screen so they don't see anything too nightmare inducing, you know.
Yeah. And does it sometimes feel incredibly shocking afresh when you look at something? Or do you feel a lot more like
I think I'm so used to it, you know. I think I'm just so used to it.
And how important is it when you're looking at a dead body, how important is it that you reach a sort of conclusion of what happens? Do you always get to a point where you've sort of worked it out?
Not always. No, unfortunately, it's quite frustrating where, you know, you've done all the tests, you've looked at everything thoroughly, and sometimes you just don't get an answer and you really want to have an answer for the family and sometimes you just don't know why someone's died, you know? And I mean, that doesn't happen that often. And sometimes it might be because they're decomposed because they've been dead for a long time. And obviously that renders it impossible to kind of find a cause of death. But yeah, sometimes that, and you know, and then it depends on the circumstances. It might be say it was a young person who dropped down dead suddenly, it might be the chance of a cardiac genetic condition or something, which you can raise the possibility of, but that often doesn't leave anything physically traced that you can see. So, but yeah, that's the aim of the game. You know, the aim of the game is to come up with a cause of a death and an explanation. So that's what you're always striving towards and thinking about tailoring you, whatever you're going to test for, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, you sort of touched upon when, you know, you saw that awful image of the little person that was the same sort of age and same hairdo to one of your children. But when you're actually the one who has to perform the autopsies and that's what's happening, how do you find it to then have to be able to sort of compartmentalise it?
So I think, you know, obviously certain cases get to you more than others. And sad to say, you know, we have a lot of cases that we, in terms of types of murders, you know, we see quite a lot of stabbings, and there it's just quite routine. And I don't mean to sound callous with that, but, you know, we do see them, we're used to seeing them. But then if you get a child or a young person, or it's particularly violent, or it's just horrible circumstances, then it's all right while you're doing it, because you just get on with it, because you just, you know, got to document all the injuries, you've got to get through it. And but yeah, I wouldn't lie by saying that I don't go away and think about them, and I can still remember. You know?
Well, it's making me think every time you read a story in the paper and it'll talk about some, you know, we've had quite a few cases, haven't we, coming out about awful examples of abuse that's been happening with kids, and they're shocking and horrible. And it's, you know, you're sort of making remember that there are people involved in that, in making those discoveries, people that are like doing the job you're doing. And I think sometimes you sort of don't, you think you hear the story and you hear the fact that they've got, and you don't think about that part of the journey that they've been on at the end, where that's all being ascertained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I suppose you're part of a big team of people that are dealing with that, from, you know, the people who first got involved, people who first discover, going to, there's lots of mechanisms for that route, to that destination of coming to some kind of picture emerging of what went on. So there is that, a sort of comfort in that. And I suppose you've got to, it's a bit like you were saying before about, you know, being able to give something to the families, and actually the justice element, that's quite a big deal, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah. Mm-hmm. And try not to get over invested in a case, but sometimes, you know, we're only human, and there have been times where, not many, but where I've felt that the outcome in the court case wasn't what I didn't feel like justice was done, and that kind of doesn't sit well, you know.
And what about you? Do you come from a family of anyone else in the medical
field? No. Not at all. I don't know where. No, my brother's not. I've got one brother. He's not in medicine, and my mum and dad were not. So I don't know where it came from.
What did they think of what you ended up doing?
I think they're really pleased. Yeah. So I always enjoyed the kind of explaining sometimes difficult concepts so that anyone can understand them. And having two parents who are not medical, I'd come back on my holidays in medical school, and I'd say, "Let me explain this. Do you understand it?" And I'd practice examination and things on like that on them, and they'd humour me, my grandparents as well.
That's brilliant. Yeah, and I suppose when you're out and about and people ask you what you do, what's the most sort of common thing that they ask you about?
The most common comment is, "Oh, I know someone who does that, because they've got like some person who did a forensic science course at uni." They think that, you know, they kind of think that, because there's forensic sciences, chemistry, biology, like crime scene investigation,
right?
But that's the science background, whereas I'm medical. So I think a lot of people don't know. Put them together. Yeah. So mostly, "Oh, that's really interesting." You know, occasionally, "Oh, I couldn't do that."
But I think most people are quite fascinated.
Yeah.
And actually, it was only really when we were talking that I sort of started to think about all the element of actually the reality of it, rather than just this sort of slightly, well, if I'm honest, part of me feels quite sort of like quite excited at the idea of actually sort of the fascination of working things out. Maybe that's just a thing that some people are kind of go, Oh, I'm really intrigued by that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that, I suppose as well, I'm just fascinated by culturally our relationship with death anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you perceive it from where you're standing, how most people deal with all of that stuff?
I think that we don't really deal with it very well, to be honest.
Mm.
I think it's kind of, I think there's a lot of denial goes on, and I think most people try to avoid it and use euphemisms. You know, they don't like to say, oh, she died. You know, they'll say she passed away, or, you know, all other things. And yeah, I don't think we deal with it well at all. No.
Yeah, it's true. It's not really something that we're... I think the euphemisms don't help at all. And I suppose for something that is so inevitable, and completely unavoidable, we're also just... We kind of don't really want to think about, you know, the possibility. Like, sometimes... I remember as a kid having this realisation, like looking at my own hand and being like, one day that hand is... That's just going... I won't be in this body anymore. And it was like a real kind of, you know, when you get that hot and cold chill when you're little, you start thinking about your own mortality.
Mm, and I did the same with my parents. I think every child thinks, but what, when you kind of get, I think they say it's not until about 7 that you realise the true permanence of it. Mm. And then it's like, and then you realise that your mum or dad could die. And I think I used to just cry at the thought of it, you know?
Yeah.
I think I'd probably still do that today, you know?
Yeah, when your daughters, so when your eldest reached that point, did you feel like you had things that could reassure her about understanding the unlikelihood of the bad things happening?
Yeah. I think, you know, she knows what I do, but she knows that most people live to an old age, you know? And I'm extremely fortunate that I've only lost my grandparents who were quite elderly, you know.
Yeah.
I have friends who've lost parents younger, and my own mum lost her mum when she was 14. And I used to think about that when I was little. I was like, I can't comprehend how awful that must be, you know.
Yeah.
I try to impress upon them that the vast, vast majority of people do live to a good age and have a nice life, you know.
Yeah, and there's a big difference between dying when you're old and then a death that's tragic.
Yeah,
a tragic death is a different thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when you got in touch, Gemma, what was it that you really wanted? Why did you want to speak to me?
That's a really good question. I thought that I'd listened to a few of your other guests, and I'd saw you'd not had a doctor on, and I was like, oh, I could add into this as a very different kind of working mum. And I'm not the only forensic pathologist working mum. I work with others as well who are juggling just the same. And I think it's just, it's the practicalities of the timing, but also, you know, the kind of emotional side. Because, you know, when you have children, you'd do anything for them, wouldn't you? You'd die for them. And then to go and see children that have died, it's just hard. It just lends a different element to being a working mother. Like, for example, when I was pregnant with my first child, I was on a paediatric placement, so I was watching the postmortem of a 32-week-old fetus. My baby was 32 weeks and I could feel her moving inside me. And that's just surreal. That's just like really, I mean, I didn't think I was bringing a living baby home, you know, when you know every single way that it can go wrong, you know.
Wow.
I didn't decorate a nursery or buy very much or anything like that, you know. And obviously all the ways that it can go wrong for mother as well with childbirth, that was, and I was overdue and I was absolutely driving myself crazy with, I didn't want to be induced because I knew about the risks of that. I didn't want to have an epidural unless absolutely necessary because I'm slightly phobic about needles in the back from when I'd done a similar procedure as a junior doctor and like hurt someone, not permanently or anything like that, but she, you know, caused someone distress, and that stayed with me. So I was like, if I can avoid having a needle in my back, that would be perfect. And so And then I was like 12 days late with her, and I was like, she finally made an appearance. But I was, you know, reading the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists guidelines about the risks of stillbirth at this. And yeah, too much knowledge is a bad thing when you're a pregnant mum.
Well, that's what I was thinking when you were saying about knowledge is good. But I was thinking, actually, sometimes accumulation knowledge introduces you to the idea of all the bad things that can happen. I mean, in my own, when I was growing up, I had in both households, so my mum's house and my dad's house with my stepmom, both my mum and my stepmom were trying to have another baby. And so my mum, she's spoken about this publicly, so I'm not, you know, giving away her private things, but she had like 10 miscarriages while I was growing up when I was a teenage years. And then in the other house, my stepmom and my dad were having IVF. So I had that around me all the time. So I thought getting pregnant was really, really hard and mm-hmm. fraught with difficulty. So I'm thinking of you when you're confronted with these things, and obviously you can reassure your kids, look what I see, most people look like. But actually, maybe when it's your day-to-day, maybe it is a bit harder to disconnect that. So when you came to have your second baby, were you more relaxed about those things, or was it worse with those things?
No, I was more relaxed, and I think because I'd successfully had a normal delivery and a healthy child, I think that, and I chose to have a home birth with my second.
Oh, amazing. I always thought that sounds so nice.
Yeah, it was. It was really lovely, apart from the agonising pain, of course, but, you know, getting to go into your own bed afterwards was nice. Yeah, and I know that some of my colleagues were astounded that I'd made that choice. But they'd had different experiences, you know, with needing assistance. And I took the very sort of practical, well, I'm low risk. And the guidance says if you're low risk, the best place to be is a maternity-led unit or at home. And I'd had my first daughter in a pool, and that had really helped me. And I hadn't been in a different area. So that was when I lived in Newcastle, and then moved to Glasgow, and there was a limited amount of pools in the ward. And I thought, psychologically, I really need the pool. The pool really helped me last time.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what pushed me into having the home birth. And I had a fantastic midwife. I had a really good experience.
Oh, how lovely. And did you go back to work fairly soon after?
Yeah, 6 months.
Okay. And again, never once questioned. It sounds like you really have found the thing that you want to do.
Oh, no. And I mean, practically I had to, because I was kind of the main breadwinner as well, you know. So, but no, definitely not. It was, I was always going to do both.
So when it's all going well, what's your favourite bit of what you do?
That's a good question. Probably just the actual autopsies, really. Yeah. And then the kind of intellectual side of trying to put it all together.
Yeah. I can imagine that.
It's satisfying. It is. And so it's not just what you find when you've done it. Like when done the autopsy, then you'll send like blood and urine away for toxicology. You might send the brain away for specialist neuropathology. And then you get all the pieces of the puzzle and you try to put them together. And sometimes it kind of all clicks. And you're like, yeah, that's it. That's what's happened. And it's quite satisfying.
That does sound satisfying. Mm. And, you know, I should probably say like sort of trigger warning for anyone is a bit squeamish, but I just really want to know what is the routine of doing an autopsy?
So you've got the body there naked, obviously, and you've read the report, so you know what sort of case it is, and then you will look them from head to toe, a full examination for injuries or signs of any disease and things like that. So you can make a record of that, we'll dictate that. And then if it's a routine postmortem, the mortuary technician will what's called eviscerate, so take the organs out. Mm-hmm. So that's from tongue to pelvic organs.
This is all soft tissue.
So make an incision at the base of the neck down to the pubic bone and remove the tongue and everything and whole. So that's called the organ pluck. So that goes in a tub and then over to the trimming bench, where I will dissect the organs in a set pattern. So you do it the same every single time, you know, so that you always weigh all the organs, you always cut them the same way, and then you have a documentation of every single organ weight and what you found.
Wow. And so that's what happens every time?
Yes.
And then sometimes it's more involved depending on what's going
on. So they might be, say, for example, if someone had broken a limb bone, you might have to dissect to look for that, or you just tailor that accordingly to what the case is.
Oh, that is actually really fascinating. And actually doesn't sound quite as sort of, I mean, presumably it's not, there's certain processes that happen to bodies once you're past death. So does it have a massive effect if you're doing it quite soon after death or a long time?
So the only thing is, if you do a postmortem quite soon, they're still warm, which is
wow,
not pleasant. I don't know. I don't enjoy that. You know, I want them to be cold and been in the fridge, and then obviously the other end is if they're very decomposed, they might just be bones, you know. But levels of decomposition, you've got to deal with that, which is maggots and obviously the smell. And
you're sometimes doing this on a location.
So do you mean going to like a scene?
Yeah.
So sometimes we don't go to many crime scenes. Sometimes people are injured and then die in hospital. So there's no need. You would only really go to a scene or a locus, as it's referred to in Scotland, if you're needed to assist with movement or if there's a question of a sexual assault to take the samples.
Mm-hmm. But otherwise, even if a body is found quite badly decomposed, it might still end up coming to
your way. It'll always end up coming to the mortuary for the post-mortem examination, yeah.
And do you feel a bit like there's like almost like the sort of club of people for whom this is commonplace everyday work, and then there's the people on the outside of it who ask questions like me?
Yeah. So, yeah, I've got lots of friends who are colleagues, both pathologists and mortuary technicians, and so, yeah.
Well, I find that quite reassuring, because I think it means that you're, you know, everybody's human, and
yeah,
and also there's a sort of routineness to it that I think is quite, yeah, again, quite reassuring.
Yeah, I think
you're running around going, oh, dead body, or being really serious. That's not really part of how we deal with anything else. So why should it be that?
Exactly. Yeah, and I think, you know, we're always respectful. Mm. Obviously, we're always respectful, and they always get obviously stitched up to a high standard so that they're viewable. You know, they're presented, they're washed, that everything. You know, and all the people who work in the mortuary pride themselves on that, you know, giving a really good service to the family.
And does it change your relationship with your own body?
Yeah, that's a good question. I try not to be a hypochondriac, you know, but I do appreciate my health.
Yeah.
I think more so in recent years, you know, I've definitely tried to optimise my own health, and I think, you know, I want to be around here for as long as possible for my daughters.
Is that part of your swimming as well? Because you like going
swimming
in the sea.
I do. I go and launch myself into cold bodies of water with a load of other crazy sort of, I'm not going to say middle-aged women. Are we middle-aged? I don't know. Mothers.
I think I'm middle-aged. I'm 42. That must be middle-aged, wasn't
it? I'm 41, so then, okay. Yeah, yeah.
It's all right. Let's own it. It's fine.
Yeah. So there's lots of women who go hooping and hollering as we get into 4-degree water.
Wow. Is that something you do quite often?
Every week now, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And have you always done that, or is it quite...
Took it up during lockdown. A friend of mine had been doing it for years, and with the swimming pool shut. And, you know, the thing was, it wasn't too cold when I took it up in May. And then the temperature drops, and one year we were breaking the ice. It was fantastic.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
What do you like about it?
It just makes you feel alive, and no matter if you're having a bad day or whatever, it just makes you feel really good. It really does. And I think it's got a lot of health benefits as well for your immune system, and it's meant to stave off dementia and things like that. But you kind of go along and you think, oh, do I really want to do this? It's so cold, you know, I'm totally crazy. What am I doing? And then you always feel better after you've done it.
You know?
It's just really kind of life affirming.
The people who get into it seem to find it really exhilarating, and just gives actually a real clarity.
Yeah.
And I guess it's part of that thing that's spoken about a lot about mindfulness, isn't it? Of just, you are just completely that person in that moment, and you're nowhere else.
Certainly, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And also, I mean, there's some absolutely gorgeous places to swim in Scotland, you know, Loch Lomond and all the Western Isle and the sea and everything like that. And I'm lucky that they're close by, and you're just getting out, you know, for example, I've had a day where I knew I had to go in to do a murder post-mortem, and I'll go up and have a swim first, and then I know I've had some fresh air, I've had some, because I'm in a room with no windows and I might be there for hours, and it's just, yeah, it's physical and mental health, really. Yeah,
I can see there's lots of benefits to that. And I did wonder, I mean, forgive me if I'm kind of getting the wrong end of this, but you were talking before about the emotional support that's there for you when you're dealing with all this stuff, and you've got your medical training, and that's all pretty, that's really incredibly solid and thorough. But this gap that you've had to form about the tricky things you see and having a life outside of it, I wonder if that was part of why you wanted to speak to me as well, just to sort of have that acknowledged a little bit.
Yeah, I think, like, I know in the sort of blurb of your podcast, it's like about finding a life outside of being doing whatever job you do and being a mum. And it's quite small, that part for me, you know, just because of pressure of time, you know.
Yeah.
But I try to get the girls involved in, you know, they've been up swimming. I mean, not when it's icy. I think that would be classed as child abuse, but chucking them in an icy lock. But, you know, they've swum in the summer with me and tried to get them outside and do things like that. So yeah, but there are things that I would like to have more time to do. I used to do am drama, I used to be in a choir and things like that, and I haven't really had time to do that, and then it all shut down. So yeah. I was about to sign up with a choir and then that stopped. So hopefully in future.
That will all come back.
Mm.
And have they ever gone to work with you?
They have. They've been in the tea room. I haven't let them, you know, when Frankie was a baby, I think she'd been in about 5 mortuaries before she was 6 months old, you know. But they just to meet my colleagues. So yeah, Frankie says she would like to see it. And I'm like, no, you're not old enough. Yeah.
I would be desperate to see it if I was her. When are you going to let her? Or, I mean, I suppose you've got the...
It would be whether it would be allowed.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe if she's like teenager and applying to medical school, then that's a different matter, isn't it? You know,
but, yeah, of course, you've got the protection of the people's privacy and everything.
Mm, exactly.
But in terms of her actually just seeing it...
Mm.
I bet, yeah, if it was me, if my mum, I'd be like, please let me come and see. I'd be completely fascinated. I'm completely fascinated now. Well, thank you very much for coming to speak to me and for so patiently answering all the questions you've probably been asked by lots of people many times over.
Pleasure.
I do think what you're doing is amazing. And I think actually that thing you said when you're saying about the doctors who have to work with people who may or may not make it, it reminded me of, there's a podcast I've been listening to called REM 5, which is done by another guest that I had called Helena Merriman. And it's about people who get these shock diagnoses. And one of them, she spoke to the doctor, the consultant that had given someone this news that he had cancer. And she said to the doctor, how do you find your relationship with your patient? And he said, I can remember every single one. And then he started crying. And it was actually a really significant moment because it made you think about, I think we're so used to having these things kind of, sometimes when something's medicalized, you can feel like it sort of knocks the edges off you. You're sort of homogenized, and all the edge that the person that you were when you walked into that building or that consulting room, you're sort of not that's all outside there. You're just a pile of notes. So sometimes, you know, like that boy you said, you know, the 15-year-old boy with all the feathers and that car accident and getting the information. There's all this world of things that happen around people, but actually how you die is like the last question mark of what happened in the big life events, if you like.
I think, and I think it's an immense privilege being any type of doctor. I mean, you know, even just the training, you know, I get to see people come into the world and go out of them and everything in between, you know, and it's, it is such a privilege. You're there with people at you know, such key moments of their life.
Yeah, absolutely. And presumably sometimes you see something on them, like a tattoo or some bit of jewellery or something. Do they still have jewellery on when you see them?
Sometimes, yeah.
And those things are really personal choices.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And then it tells you a little bit more about them and just sort of, I suppose I'd probably find myself inclined to sort of chat to them or something.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a difference. I'm not religious, but I think you have to keep an open mind. And I always felt like it was different when someone had just died as opposed to someone I see who's been dead for a while. And if you believe, I, I don't know what I believe, but I just feel like, you know, if there is a soul or something like that, it's kind of gone when by the time we get
them. No, I totally understand that. I've only really seen one dead body of like a family member, and he just wasn't the same person anymore.
No.
And I was actually so shocked at how quickly it was the carrier, not the person.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually really remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know really where I stand on all that, but it's definitely, there's definitely a shift.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people find it difficult to recognise their relatives because I think, you know, there's we need the life and the in your eyes, really, to recognise someone who they are. It can be very difficult to see them.
It's just not them and not them at the same
time. Yeah, exactly. They're not there.
Yeah. Oh, it's absolutely amazing. I'm sure I'll think of more things later. Maybe I'll have to text you or something.
That's fine.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, I hope that's given you some food for thought. And thank you very much to Gemma for reaching out to me, actually. I had a lovely conversation with her and it really stayed with me. I think it's quite incredible, really, what people end up doing for a living. And it's interesting how, you know, we're still very squeamish about the idea of death, but obviously all these jobs need to happen and all these roles need to be filled. And actually, I know a lot of people who are really fascinated by all of it. I think I'm pretty fascinated by all of it. And finding out how you make it part of your day-to-day and the bits that become almost quite mundane. Well, it's a very interesting insight. So if anyone out there listening has got a job that you think I need to hear about and you'd like to talk to me, then please do reach out. It's really nice to hear from you and hear what's going on. And yeah, everybody's got a story, haven't they? Meanwhile, I'm sat here with Mickey. He's watching Ryan's toy review, Ryan's World. Are you familiar with him? You probably are.
Who's that, Mummy?
That's Ryan from Ryan's World.
No, I mean, what are you talking
to? Oh, I'm recording. I'm recording a bit of my podcast. And Ryan, he's ridiculously successful. I think last year he earned something like $22 million, and he's about like 10, and his YouTube channel's called Ryan's World, and I always say, it's Ryan's World, we just live in it, don't we, Mickey?
I'm not watching
it. I know, you've stopped now, you're watching a little dance routine now, aren't you? Look at that, look at them jumping around. Anyway, thank you to you, thank you to Gemma, thank you to Richard for letting me hand my homework in very late on a Sunday, thank you to Claire Jones for being my brilliant editor and producer. Sorry, it's not my editor, that's Richard. Oh my God, my brain. And thank you to LMA for the amazing artwork. But as ever, thank you to you for lending me your ears. And I hope you have a peaceful week. And I hope you don't mind me sharing what happened in Liverpool the other day. It's just quite... My mum told me not to compartmentalise it. Oh, actually, I'll tell you something really interesting. After I'd witnessed the shocking event that was quite traumatic, I happened to have my Game Boy with me, which had Tetris. And there was an Oxford study that said, if you play Tetris within 6 hours... of a traumatic event, it can actually help to reduce post-traumatic stress. So after I went back up to my hotel room after the police were there and, you know, the chap, you know, definitely, they tried some CPR and he was declared dead and, you know, we'd given our statements, we could go upstairs. I played Tetris for quite a while before I did my gig and I'm actually pretty convinced it helped, actually, because I felt... okay, you know, definitely something I had to process a bit, but I felt okay in terms of my anxiety. Anyway, so, you know, if you've got a Game Boy and some Tetris, do it. If you see anything shocking, it might help. All right, on that note, have a lovely week and I'll speak to you next week for the last one of the series. Who will it be? See you soon. What's up?
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.